Brad, do you remember a couple weeks, maybe a couple months back, we were talking about how different people's brain narrates the world? So some people see the world with abstract images, right? Like you see a toaster, you see that you need to put the toast in the toaster, right? That's the narration of symbolism and icons and images, right? And then there's a whole other group of people that see the world through narration, through words. I am going to go to the refrigerator. I would like to get a new job. I am having trouble in my relationships, whatever that is, right? And you and I came down on the fact that we go through the world with a narration, with an internal dialogue.
Yes.
And I was talking with my wife about this same thing, my television writer wife, Gloria, and she said, I also narrate the world and I'm constantly creating dialogue amongst myself or among fake people or people that I pass in the street. Mm-hmm. And it's very similar to you and I. Basically, we're narrating our world, right, as we go through it. And so as a fun experiment, she and I were out walking the dog the other day, and I said, let's play this game. Let's share externally our internal monologue as it's going, as we go on this puppy walk, right?
Uh-huh.
We were walking the dog.
Wait a minute. You went walking through the park with your wife and with the idea that you were going to say the first thing that came to your mind as you're walking around?
Yes, where is this joke going?
You're taking an incredible risk. I'd be two yoga pants away from a black eye.
All right, so we're going around the park and or around the block, and my wife is she goes first and she starts narrating. She goes, "All right, I got to finish that project. Let's see, I got to send that email when we get back. All right, the dishes need to be done. Yeah, dishes got to get done. All right, and then we're gonna. Oh boy, the kids have to. I got to order those new. Everyone's outgrowing their clothes. I got to get new shorts on Amazon or something. Oh, okay, Where basically it was a series of worries and lists, right, in my wife's internal narration. But it was like all the stuff that I got to get done today, or all the stuff I got to worry about this week, right? That was her internal narration.
Mm-hmm.
And then for me, my narration as we're going on this walk was, oh, wow, look at that tree. I wonder how it knows how to sprout leaves in that direction towards the sun. Ooh, I like the way that brick is laid on that house. Have I ever laid brick? Yeah, I laid brick once. I wasn't very good at it. Oh, look at that dog. That dog has a nice tail. Oh, my gosh, that's a much fluffier tail than my dog's tail. Oh, my God. Oh, a car. Oh, that's an 87 Chevrolet. Oh, I like that one. Oh, that's neat. Just all observational. Like, do you remember that dog in Up that's like, talk, 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 squirrel? You know, that kind of thing?
Right.
That was my internal monologue, and I hadn't realized until I talked to Gloria and expressed it out loud I'm basically observation, 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 observation. But maybe that's why it makes it work that I am a comic strip cartoonist, because I'm constantly like, that's weird, that's interesting, that's weird. Oh, look at that.
Oh, definitely that. That's the first thing I thought when you said, look at that tree, I wonder how its leaves know the right way to grow. That's the way a cartoonist thinks about something. But there's also something else going on there that I don't even know that you recognize. Gloria's mind is constantly on the future. This thing is coming up, that thing is coming up, I need to prepare. You are in the moment. You're right there in what's happening right now.
That's what so we had a really long philosophical discussion after this, because she said, all joking aside, her first reaction was, oh my God, you're crazy. And the second reaction she had, though, was, oh, you know what? There's advantages and disadvantages to both routes as far as an internal monologue.
Yeah.
And one is, for her, she is constantly planning in there, and that's how she's able to get, frankly, more stuff done in her life than I am.
Mm-hmm.
She is a great planner. She loves lists. She loves to-do lists. She loves checklists. She loves getting stuff done. And that she gets joy out of that, right? And that's good. The advantage and disadvantage, she said, is like, well, you have something I don't have, which is you are present in the moment. You are truly experiencing your life as you are going through it right there. You're not worried about the future.
Yes.
And I said, well, there are moments of anxiety where I absolutely worry about the future. But yes, I broadly speaking, enjoy the moment that I'm in, because I'm observing it and I'm present in the moment. And I think that's why I jokingly have that sort of kind of attitude about life, is because I'm in the moment, you know? But that has disadvantages in that maybe I'm not as prepared as she is for what might be coming down the pipe, you know?
I'm going to ask you a question, because this plays right into a theory that I've had for a long time. When it comes to pictures of the family and you open up your phone, who has more pictures of the kids, her or you?
Both of us, actually. Oh, but that's okay. I'm curious to see what your question is.
Because here's the thing. I'm kind of like you in that I'm in the moment. I'm experiencing what's happening right now. I know that about myself. When something's happening with the kids, I come home and I say, oh, Carolyn, it was so great. You know, such and such went up and did this thing. The first thing she'll say is, did you get a picture? And I'm like, no, I was enjoying the moment. I was too busy in the moment to think about recording the moment, you know? This even goes to like when we took Max to space camp a few years back and he went up and got his space camp diploma. I had to really, Carolyn sent me a text that morning. Don't forget to take pictures because I would have totally been sitting there clapping my hands being, oh, look at that. He must've had such a good time. I would have been in such the moment guy. I would have completely forgotten to take photos and video because I'm enjoying it in the moment.
Well, you know what's funny? Because I don't mind your attitude because I go to, like, say, the kids' Christmas pageant every year, right?
Yes.
And I see just this sea of upraised phones.
I hate it.
And for me, it's like, you're not going to rewatch that, first of all.
No one's watching that video, that shaky,
crappy version of little Timmy singing in a different direction than everybody else is singing during the Christmas pageant. But also, like, enjoy that moment. Like, yes. I actively make a choice. Like, nah, I'm not going to film this because then you're worried about your camera, your phone, whatever it is, and you're not worried about just enjoying the moment. Yeah, so I'm with you on that, Brad. I think I see what you're saying, that even though my wife and I have the same number of photos, I try to, in certain moments, be like, just put the phone away and enjoy the moment.
Yeah. This is what you're here for. You're here. This is what all those diapers and late nights were about. This is the part where you get to sit back and say, this is what it is to be a parent. I'm so proud of this kid right now.
That's right. This is what you're here for. Yes.
Yeah.
And speaking of what you're here for, I'm going to say hello, everybody, and welcome to Comic Lab. Look at that transition.
Wow.
And a show about making comics.
And making a living from comics. I'm Brad Geiger, editor of webcomics.com and creator of Evil Inc.
And I'm his friend Dave Kellett, cartoonist of Drive and Sheldon and co-director of Stripped.
And this week's hour of comics advice is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So Dave, let's talk comics.
Let's talk comics, my friend. We had a thing we wanted to swing back around on for everybody that remembered. We had talked and asked our listenership to let us know if they could think of someone of either a title or an artist who was able to successfully go home again, basically, to go back to Narnia, go back to Oz, having stepped away from their title for a while. And Brad, we got some responses to that, right?
This is great. We've got two really good ones that are perfect examples. The first one comes in from Comic Lab backer Bob Glasscock, who says, quote, I'm a little late catching this episode, but I couldn't help notice this is the second time on the topic of big cartoonists making a comeback that you forgot Gary Trudeau.
Huh.
Doonesbury stopped for about 2 years in the early 80s and then came back strong. And I'm just going to put a footnote in there, rebooted his entire strip. Everybody went from college to adult life. But back to Bob's words, and did brilliant work through the 90s and is still going strong. So that's one that we forgot of a return to Oz.
That is interesting. I did. You know what? That was a little bit before my politic comics time, in terms of reading comics that were about politics. And so I wasn't yet a Doonesbury fan, I think, when that was happening.
Yeah, I was a Doonesbury fan. I read it when I was reading newspaper comics. Doonesbury was a must on my reading list. But
also you're being a much, much older man than I am. It was probably more
more mature, yes, but
more
much
mature.
Older, maybe not.
Yes. No, I'm kidding. But it was on your radar. So that was just one that you had slipped your mind, huh?
Yeah, for some reason, this is true. When we're talking about, big cartoonists, we keep forgetting Gary Trudeau. And he really has to be thrown into the mix there, especially as somebody who was an avid use of satire and political humor.
Let me ask you why that might be, Brad. Why do you think we forget about Trudeau so much?
That's a really good question. A part of the reason might be that the comics that you and I really like are the comics that kind of spark joy. Like part of the reason that you love Bloom County is Opus. And part of the reason you love Calvin and Hobbes is Hobbes and that relationship. And part of the reason that you love some of these comics are because they spark such a sense of joy. Reading Doonesbury is not a joyful experience all the time. In fact, there's very little of that. It's more of a snarky satire kind of thing, which is still good. I'm not putting it down.
Yeah, no, it
but
has
it's,
place,
it's hard to occupy a space in my heart for that.
Yeah, for me, I think my spidey sense with Trudeau and why I give him less shrift than I should. Is that the right use of that phrase? Giving somebody
short
less shrift?
Short shrift, yes.
So I'm giving them short shrift or shorter shrift than he deserves. Boy, you can't really change that phrase. You can either say short shrift or you don't say anything else.
You cannot give an appropriate amount of shrift.
Brad, I have an extensive amount of shrift to give.
I've got so much shrift for you. You can't imagine the amount of shrift.
Brad, I am full of. I've got bags of shrift. I'm full of shrift over here.
Dave, I'd like. Dave, welcome to our dinner party. I want you to meet Phil. Phil has so much shrift for you. You're gonna really enjoy.
Look,
Phil.
I don't give a shrift about Phil. Here's my spidey sense with Trudeau: is that there is from the moment of creation with the Doonesbury, there is an expiration date on that comic strip.
Yeah,
and it's usually 24 hours. You know.
Yeah.
And so we've talked before about the comics that will still be read 100 years from now. Peanuts will be read 100 years from now. Mm-hmm. Watterson will be read 100 years from now. Doonesbury, you flip back even 5 years ago sometimes to a Doonesbury, and you're like, what the hell was this about? I have no idea what this story of the day from 2005 was. What is this? I don't remember these people. I don't remember this news event. What I mean?
That's the truth.
Doonesbury is a beautifully done, excellently done satire commentary on the politics and culture of our time that is kind of like single-use plastic in that once it's used, you never go back to it again, you know?
Yeah, that's the truth. It has a very short expiration date.
And I say that like I have a Doonesbury, a beautiful Sunday Doonesbury up in my studio.
Yes.
And beautifully done, inarguably one of the most impactful comics in politics, especially in the latter 20th century in America. Probably way more impactful than any political cartoon, don't you think?
Absolutely.
In terms of this, what we associate as the single panel.
Absolutely.
Like those kind of lost their punch around World War II, but Doonesbury found a new format and really brought it back. Anyway, but we do give it short shrift. You're right.
Yes. Well, then let's shrift our attention to the other one on the list.
Shrift our attention, ladies and gentlemen, Brad Geiger. Oh, my goodness.
And this one came from somebody that was so wound up about this that he joined our Patreon just so he could post it on our Patreon page.
Oh, my God.
So this comes in. We'll have to.
Someone, Brad, angrily asking you out on prom just to tell you, like, I've got some points I need to make.
Yeah,
will you go to prom with me?
That's right. You get over here. Go to the prom. I don't know that he was angry, but he signed up for Patreon just to give us this, and he clearly must be a fan. Seth Brower writes, quote, "The original Laird and Eastman Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles ran from Mirage from 1984 to 1993, with the main series having 62 issues. They had a volume 2 right afterwards with Jim Lawson taking over that only ran 13 issues. There was a series attempt by Eric Larson from 96 to 99 that ran 23 issues, but it was published by Image and not work done by the original creator, so it was largely written off by the fans. So when it comes to Mirage, with either Laird and Eastman on board, there was a long gap. It wasn't until 2001 that we get Laird and Lawson, coming back to continue the series where it was left off in Volume 2 and actually having the gap in publishing align with the passage of time in the world. The series ran for 31 issues before they sold their rights to Nickelodeon. So he says, I'd argue that having a run from 2001 to 2014 after about a 20-year absence would qualify, and many fans thought that the version 4 was the true return to storytelling and characters of the original that was well-liked. So Seth comes in and says, hey, don't forget about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles with the original Laird and Eastman team.
That's a really good point. That's another one that a little bit doesn't get the attention. It also gets some lessened shrift than it mm-hmm. should from Dave Kellett, just because it's a few years past my time in terms of my dive into that type of comic. But that we should do a show, Brad, where at some point down the line, where we talk about Deadpool versus Deathstroke and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles versus Daredevil, mm-hmm. where the thing that's mimicking the original becomes a bigger success than the original itself.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Because that's a fascinating little subset, especially in superhero comics, of the satire, the joke thing becomes bigger than the original. You know?
Yeah, and that was Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was a joke. These guys were sitting around at a comic convention going, take a look at these comics that are so successful. They all fall into a pattern and a format, and they came up with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles just to completely mock them, and it turned into a huge franchise.
And Deadpool was the same thing, right? Deadpool, yeah. Deathstroke, mm-hmm. was the, wasn't that Slade Wilson and Wade Wilson or something?
I believe so.
Yeah. But we should, at some point we can talk about that down the line about the spoof that becomes bigger than the original.
Yeah.
Maybe because they truly embrace the ridiculousness of whatever the original concept was.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the original a little bit took themselves seriously enough where they didn't dive all in, whereas the spoof went, no, hell with it. This is ridiculous and we're going to go with it.
We're going to completely, well, yes, I think there is that moment where you completely abandon all caution, and that's when your creativity really comes out.
Right.
And I think that, and like we've said on the show 100 times, audiences respond to somebody really being their fullest creative self, whatever that is. Don't spend any time trying to think of what should I do that would become popular?
Right.
What would people like? Do the thing that brings out your creative gusto, and people will respond to it, even if you think it's really stupid.
Well, and also, yeah, exactly. That's the idea that they fully dive in, they fully enjoy their creative experience, mm-hmm. makes probably for a better Deadpool and a better Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, because they're not half apologizing, if you know what I mean, Brad.
Right, right.
Oh, well, I mean, yeah, we're having fun, but it's also still a serious story, and Daredevil's going to fight the bad guys, you know, that kind of thing. anyway, all that, we should circle back around on that when we've had time to think about it, because that could be a fun topic. But we've got one, a $5 question, Brad, that's come in from patreon.com/comiclab from Raj Solanki. And Raj, by the way, Raj has come by a studio con for us. It came by Drunk Comic Lab. And it is nice to start to see faces through these visual interactions. So thank you, Raj, for coming by.
Yeah.
And Raj writes, in the next couple months, I'm going to be moving from Denver, Colorado to Waco, Texas. Mm. Well, that's a nice move, by the way. Waco has that whole series of craftsman houses and stuff. From mm-hmm. As much as I appreciate online communities, I would love to build an in-person community of artist friends. Any tips on how to find, build a local art community in a new environment where you don't know anyone? Bradley Geiger, if there's one person that I can throw into any situation socially and he immediately goes up and talks to 100 people, it's Brad Geiger. Let me ask you. No, I'm joking. I'm joking.
Yeah, you sure are. Well, listen, so the first thing that I would do would be I would set up for Twitter or any social media. I would start in TweetDeck. You can have some keywords that anytime they show up in Twitter, it funnels them into this column. And I would put Waco and comics into a standing search and just look at it every couple of days to see who's talking about comics in Waco. Right. And
right.
then you could eventually you're going to get like a comic convention that comes through Waco, which is your other step, too, is once comic conventions start happening in person again, you show up at comic conventions and kind of circulate around. But my first step would be setting up a search in Twitter just so I can see every time the words Waco and comics come up in the same reference and then reaching out to those people that are clearly from the region. What do you think, Dave?
That's interesting. As you know, and I have said this many times on the show, I personally detest Facebook and don't like it. But one thing that Facebook does really well mm-hmm. is geographic specific groups and searches. And so even more so than Twitter, I think you might want to jump on Raj Facebook for a second to see what you're able to find there. But here's my advice for you, Raj, and I don't know how much of this is immediately applicable to Waco. I've only driven through there once. But I would suggest looking up to see if any either the Society of Illustrators or the National Cartoonist Society or I'm trying to think of another group, but those are the two that pop into mind, if they have a Texas branch. Unfortunately for Waco, it's of a size where you might not get the branch meeting in Waco. It might be down in Houston or in Dallas or something like that. So you might be out of luck, but maybe you'll get lucky. And maybe there happens to be a few members that even though they go to the Dallas meeting, they're from Waco and then you've got some pals. So that's one option. Another option I would strongly recommend is there's 1,000 drink and draw events. And by the way, all this advice, Raj, is most clearly for after the pandemic, right?
Right.
So it's a year from now, a year and a half from now when everybody's been vaccinated. So you're back out on the scene on Waco. I would look up drink and draw sessions that are, there's a whole series, a whole network of these that are take place all over the US and Canada and Europe. And drink and draws are basically a night at a bar where people are hanging out. Sometimes there's games. Sometimes it's a socialization event. Sometimes there's a shared drawing activity. That's one. Another one would be take a live drawing class. Live drawing classes are great for seeing who has a cartoony look, even if they are an artist, and that can spring into conversations. A third one would be to take an adult education drawing class, but specifically for line art, because you might find that there are other cartoonists in that same type of class, right? And then the final one that I would suggest is local art fairs and or book fairs, because if there's one thing we know about independent cartoonists, they will find a place to set up a table and try to sell some books.
Yes, they will.
And so you will go to the Waco Library Book Fair or Author Fest or the Waco Artist Exhibition, and there will be a tent or tents and books and tables. But among them all, there will be two cartoonists, and they'll be selling their books. And I promise you, you will find somebody in that. Brad, any thoughts on that? Any bills on that one?
I'll just put one capper that I just thought of as you were talking, and that is also go to the local comic shop and find
Bradley.
Out.
Bradley! Sorry, that got a dumb reaction on my part. I think I spiked my microphone. That was such a big reaction.
Yeah, you may have. No, go to your local comic shop and ask around. I guarantee you some of the local cartoonists have come in asking about selling their books on commission and stuff like this, and you can find out there as well whether there's a local community.
So I think, Raj, there's about 7 or 8 ideas there.
Yeah.
Actually, we banged out a couple of really good ideas there in short order. You can definitely search online on Twitter or on Facebook. I don't know. Does Instagram allow geographic searches? I don't think it does.
Boy, you can put in a geographic location for your post, so I'm assuming there must be a way, but I don't know about it off the top of my head.
Boy, this is Grandpa and Grandpa's friend out on the porch. How does Instagram work? So, yeah, you can definitely do electronic searches. I think there's a good 5 or 6 ideas there for in terms of local meetups or artist events. Community colleges tend to do cartooning classes. I don't necessarily recommend the quality or level of cartooning you'll get at that kind of a class. But maybe by researching that class, you'll see that the professor lives locally and you could reach out to him and say, hey, are there any cartooning groups?
Right.
Because someone who's lived in Waco all their life and teaches a class on cartooning, they are going to know the 5 people in Waco that are cartoonists. You know what I mean, Brad?
Yep, absolutely. Oh, and just to let you know, on Instagram, I just put Philadelphia in, and you can absolutely search by place.
Well, Grandpa and Grandpa's friend figured it out, everybody. See? No need to give us some lessened amount of shrift. We were able to figure it out.
We have just the appropriate amount of shrift. So, Dave, you've got a topic that you'd like to talk about in the first half of the show here. The thought that you want to get across is about thinking about the person receiving your art. And I want to hear more about that.
Well, okay, yes. Yeah. So I started telling you about this, and we decided to bring it into the show. So my wife, as I mentioned at the top of the show, is a TV showrunner. She's a writer.
Yeah.
And she's currently developing a couple of projects for Amazon Prime TV, right? And she happened to mention offhand that when she was developing One Day at a Time, her philosophy for that show was, I want to send you a hug through the television. That was that was her guiding philosophy. And that struck me as so groundbreaking a way of thinking about developing a project that I wanted to talk to you about this, Brad.
Yeah.
Because from when I stopped to think about it, what I try to do with Sheldon is I'm trying to send pal times through a comic strip with Sheldon, right?
Pal times?
Pal times. Just like, hey, we're being pals. You know, we're having fun looking at the world. Oh, hey, we're having this pal times, Brad.
Yeah.
It's pal times. And so I was curious to hear you, Brad, what mood, what intonation you were sending through your comic, because it's a fun way to think about it. Different than the story, different than the characters. What are you sending through the comic when you write an Evil Inc? And wait a minute. Before you answer this, I should distinguish. I'm not asking about your After Dark version of Evil Inc. We all know what you're sending on that one.
That's right. There's no question there. No, I honestly, kind of what I'm sending out in general is kind of a shared love for comic book history, for this whole genre of superhero comics that most of us have grown up with or become very familiar with. And that's really kind of the heart of what I'm sending out we've got this whole construct of people running around in spandex with capes, and Evil Inc. treats them as office workers with interconnections that office workers would have.
Right.
And isn't that weird that we've just accepted as a group that we're going to have these stories that have lasted for decades and decades with the basic focal point that you put a cape on and you go out and fight crime.
Yeah.
So my thought is a shared love for comics history.
That's an interesting way to look at it. Like, hey, we're together having read comics. Now we're going to share in the weirdness of it and laugh and have adventures.
Yeah. Yeah. If you accept comics as American mythology, it's kind of like a shared appreciation of that myth.
God, I've heard that before, but it's been years since I thought about it that way. Superhero comics are American mythology, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. They really, and so much of them reflects where we are at the time. You know, using the obvious one, the 1960s, so many characters were getting their superpowers through atomic energy and through atomic mishaps,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's very reflective of where we are at the time. And there's a lot to appreciate from that much storytelling.
Yeah, it's funny how you can draw a direct line between early American mythos like Paul Bunyan.
Mm-hmm.
And go right to superheroes. You know,
yes.
You can see where Americans are drawn to that idea of the single individual who, through sheer strength and courage and bravery, is helping out others and saving the day and, you know, that kind of thing.
And you really, I mean, not to take it onto a tangent, but you really see how different we think about that if you, like me, have started watching My Hero Academia, which takes on superheroes from a very, very Japanese point of view.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah.
Their culture is it takes on this whole thing very, very differently. And it's much more about the group and it's about each other and what the unit is doing more so than sometimes the individual. And also about the honor and the dignity and what I should do to be a moral person. It's very different type of writing, and it'll smack you right in the face.
Yeah, it's funny how Japanese superhero comics are much more like in the vein of that JFK speech of ask not what your country can do for you, ask for what you can do for your country.
Yes.
In the sense of like you should subsume a little bit your ego, your individuality, and help the group, help the greater good, help the, you know, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like every American group comic is, can we keep this ragtag group of individualists together to fight crime?
Right.
You know, that's every Avengers comic, that's every X-Men, that's every, like, they're like, all these individuals, so it's tough to keep them together, you know, that kind of thing.
They've all got their own selfish needs and interests, and they've got to do something good, but we got to get past them being selfish.
And literally the only thing that brings them together is some massive external threat that they can't fight on their own.
That they can't turn their back on.
My God, if that is not a metaphor for Americans coming together, I don't know what it is.
Boy, the sooner the better.
So everyone, just a reminder, put on a damn mask. That's what we're saying.
Which is also a good superhero metaphor.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, so I wanted to share that with Comic Lab listeners, the idea of thinking about what message you are sending through your comic. Because are you sending a sense of excitement, right, if you're writing an adventure comic? Are you sending a high five through your comic if you're if you're writing about friends and humor? Are you sending a ray of light if you're trying to do an uplifting or positive thing? Are you sending hope? Are you sending, what are you sending through the comic? And that's a different way of looking at it than saying, I'm writing about cowboys. I'm writing about robots. I'm writing, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You're trying to reach through your comic and ask, who is receiving this comic and what am I sending them? And I thought that's a helpful way for people to conceptualize when they're developing a project.
I like that a lot.
Hey, if you're listening while you work, take a minute to stand and stretch.
And while you're doing that, we're going to tell you why you should join us on Patreon.
When you do, you're going to get hours and hours of podcasts that we've recorded just for backers.
And exclusive Patreon posts that go even deeper on Comic Lab topics.
And access to our exclusive Discord server, which is a thriving community of professional cartoonists.
So you can support the show you love and get tons of actionable resources for your own cartooning.
And listen, if you can't swing a pledge this month, we get it. No worries.
Yeah, listen, you can still support the show by rating us wherever you get your podcasts.
Just leave a 5-star review and a few kind words.
That, along with mentions on social media, is incredibly helpful.
Now, everybody, let's talk comics.
So, Dave, this show is being brought to you by our good friends at Wacom, makers of the incredible Wacom One, a fantastic portable pro-level tablet that both of us use in our studios. And I just want to say, what's the thing that you've got on your Wacom One right now?
I'll tell you, the thing that, I love the portability aspect where I can do concept stuff on that one. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I, having the big Cintiq Pro in the studio, I tend to do a lot of my drawing on that one, like the nuts and bolts stuff. But the Wacom One is great for sitting on the couch, sitting in my bed, sitting outside. Sitting, well, I don't know, wherever. I was going to say sitting in my car, but why would I be sitting in my car?
You do a lot of sitting, don't you?
Yeah, you can see why I'm gaining weight, Brad. I really need to go for a jog. But for me, the great thing about the Wacom One is I still can't get over the fact that had this existed at key points in my career, the idea of being able to get a $400 Wacom, had this existed like 15 years ago, would have blown my mind. I mean, do you remember how much these things cost when they first came out?
Woof. Yeah, these were really expensive units when they first came out.
And now to have this ability, technological ability with a Wacom One now for $400 with that super portability and the super lightweight interactive experience has been awesome. So, yes, a huge thank you and a shout out to our sponsors, Wacom at WACOM.com, the new makers of the Wacom One. And Bradley J. Geiger, it's time for our next $5 question coming in over at patreon.com/comiclab from Ryan Summers. And Ryan writes, while I've been plotting out my comic, I had an idea for a secondary story thread that could kick off from events that take place in the first chapter. It would be a separate set of characters that aren't essential to the main plot, but could be a fun backstory to the main thread. Do you have opinions on running a Patreon-exclusive story thread that forks out of your main free-to-read comic, and then at some point, that thread and set of characters gets maybe woven back into the main storyline that everyone can access? Is anyone out there doing something like this? I'm guessing the hard part is figuring out how essential the story thread should be to the main plot, but I'm kind of excited about this idea of running concurrent storylines at the same time, one for everyone and one behind the Patreon paywall. Thanks. All the pro tips and especially the writer's room have been great inspiration to get moving on my comic. Oh, good.
Oh, cool.
That's fun to hear, by the way, Brad, that writer's room, which is a Patreon exclusive, has been helpful because those have been both fun to do and for us anyway, instructive on how the other one works. So that's good to hear.
So let's take that from the top. Dave, have you ever done a Patreon exclusive story that branches off from your main comic?
So, Brad, I have done maybe 16 or so branching off stories. Now, to be fair, they were Patreon exclusive at first, but then were rolled into the main site and into the books very intentionally. as extensions of in-world storytelling. And for those not familiar with my science fiction strip, Drive, I call those standalone stories, which range from 6 to 15 pages. Mm-hmm. Those are called Tales of the Drive rather than Drive. They're very similar to the old standalone Star Wars comics that Dark Horse did, where you might follow a bounty hunter that was obliquely referenced, or you might follow some weird hut that you've never heard of before, that kind of thing. And so that's what these stories in Drive do. And Brad, how about you? Have you, Brad, ever done a Patreon exclusive storyline or offshoot for folks?
Yeah, that's kind of what Evil Inc. After Dark is. That's exactly what it is. There's multiple times when a storyline gets to a certain point in Evil Inc. I'll put a little note up. This is continued at Patreon. And you're right. The Ryan is right on all of Ryan's instincts. In other words, is this a good idea? Yes. Exclusives work really well on Patreon. Giving somebody a reason and giving something value for their Patreon backing that they can say, I get this thing that nobody else is getting.
Right.
That's fantastic, especially if there's a demand for it. That's going to work really well. And this idea of taking this side story and making it that exclusive and then maybe winding it back in later on. Fantastic. That's a great idea. The main thing you're going to struggle with there, and it just is going to be a little bit of a creative challenge for you, is at some point, you're going to have, you don't want to have so much wrapped up in that exclusive story that people can't understand your main story because of the content over there. And mine, I keep Evil Inc. After Dark completely exclusive. It never comes out to the public. So you've got to be a Patreon backer to read that stuff, or a Kickstarter backer, or buy the books. But if you're just reading Evil Inc. on the main website, then, you're going to miss all that stuff. And I've got to write it in such a way that if those plot points do come back, I write it in such a way that kind of gives them a quick catch up to the stuff that they may have missed.
Right. So one of the things I want to leap off there is Brad was talking about, don't make it so dependent on this exclusive story that the other people are lost.
Right.
And the really good parallel that I think we can easily point to is if you ever read Marvel or DC in the 90s or 2000s, as a sales technique, they started doing these wraparound stories that like every title and their brother was involved in this massive story, right?
Yeah.
And you suddenly had to buy a title that you never had bought before, and in order to get some key detail in the story. But where Marvel did it right was, maybe you did it, but or maybe you needed it, but maybe you could also kind of skip that one if you had to, right?
Right.
And I think Brad and I would err more on the side of have it standalone enough that it's not central to the main storyline, such that you don't force somebody. But boy, is it enhancing the storyline or enhancing the world overall, while still not being a critical juncture of like, wait, Greg is dead? That character died? When did Greg die? Oh, it's in the exclusive. All right. Yeah. Hold on.
Yeah. If that plot point comes up again, you just say, one of the characters says, how did Greg die? He died in that bank heist. And then the story moves on. The bank heist is its own whole story, but you've just given your readers everything they need to go on with the story. They're not going to be confused. Greg died in the bank heist. If they want to know all about the bank heist, then that's a great excuse for you to promote that Patreon exclusive, but it's not a necessary part. You just gave them the part, you gave them the plot point they needed to understand what's coming up next.
That's right. And so as far as exclusives go, Brad, one thing I wanted to ask you is your exclusives for Evil Inc., and this is a related but not intimately related question.
Yeah.
Your exclusives for Evil Inc., how do you, without showing the world what it is, how do you entice people to what it is? Do you know what I mean?
Well, there, on social media, it has a lot to do with, putting a cropped image up and saying, here's the storyline that's going on right now. I redesigned my website so that's a really big part of the top of the site are those kind of entries. So it's like, this thing is going on. A little snippet of the story, a little teaser, if you will. And then, like I said, I do this quite often in the main comic. Put just a little note at the bottom of the comic saying, to be continued at patreon.com/Geiger. So that if people want to use that as a jumping in place, this is a good opportunity for them to do that. And then when I'm assembling the collections and stuff, a lot of times I'll bring in a few pages from Evil Inc. to lead into an Evil Inc. After Dark story. So I'll kind of give people that sense of familiarity and show them visually that these two things are crossing over all the time.
And Brad, is it a cruelty to, like, say it's a 15-page standalone story, is it a cruelty to run the first 10 pages on the site and the last 5 pages are only on Patreon?
You know what? I would step away from doing, because I think that is a little bit unfair to get somebody invested 10 pages in and then to blackmail them with that, those last five pages.
It is kind of emotional blackmail, isn't it?
Yeah, it kind of is. I have no problem keeping the entire storyline separate. And again, you don't need to know that storyline to follow the main story that's happening at Evil Inc. But to get them emotionally invested and then say, okay, you want to see the last 5 pages, you got to pay up. That is not something I'm as crazy about. I'm sure there's people that find ways of doing it, but that wouldn't be quite so much to my taste.
Well, I'm glad you had that answer, because my answer is the exact same thing, which is for your career, play the long game in terms of what you're giving people for free. And so often, I know it sounds cliche that we say this a lot, but let kindness be your guiding light on this, because I did the same thing during the last recession, and I'm trying to do the same thing during this pandemic and depression, which is that, listen, I know you might not be able to afford a book or a comic, but there's 4,000 Sheldons in the archive you can read for free.
Yes.
You'll get me down the road when you've got a couple extra dollars in your pocket. Mm-hmm. Don't worry. Read Sheldon for free right now. My God, get through this moment. And then later on, a year or two from now, when you've got some money, go ahead and pick up a Sheldon book. But you don't have to be on Patreon if you can't swing it. You don't have to buy a book right now if you can't swing it. Enjoy the free comics. And I found, Brad, that kindness, that extension of like, listen, you'll get me later on when things are better. For right now, enjoy the free comics. Mm-hmm. That kindness has come back to me in spades, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Down the road. And it's also a nicer way to live rather than emotionally blackmailing people of like, you got the first 12 pages for page 13. You got to be on Patreon, you know?
Yeah, I'm not crazy about that. I'm not, you'd have to present it very carefully. Like, for example, if you were going to go down that road, you would not want to make it a surprise on page 11. You know,
oh, that's true.
You read page 10. Now page 11 is a surprise. You could, if you were kind of saying all along, okay, now this is what we're going to do after page 10, it goes exclusive. Then that might be a way that you could do that. But again, I'm kind of an all or nothing person anyway. And I think I would, if you're going to do an exclusive. Besides, here's the other side of that. Exclusives are powerful on Patreon. If you've got a 15-page story and you're only making 5 pages exclusive, you're missing the boat. That's 15 pages of exclusives that you got there, not 10 pages of public and 5 pages of exclusive.
And I will say this. I personally still feel like there is power to dribbling and drabbling things out.
Yeah.
Here's what I mean by that. Some people are like, the Patreon exclusive is you get the whole 40-page comic right away. Bidi-bada-ding, bada-bidi-boom, right?
Right, right.
And so, yes, you can do that. I would say that there is an emotional strength and, frankly, a bond that people can form stronger when they are checking in with an Evil Inc. update that happens once a week or once a day rather than all 40 pages all at once. And then they're done with it and then they're on to the next thing, you know?
Right.
So even if it's a Patreon exclusive, I personally would propose doing it on a repeated pattern rather than on throwing it all out at once. Don't you think, Brad?
Yeah. Well, and you'll also find out that it's a little bit easier to do that, too. You know,
because
if you're not doing that, then there's long periods of time when they're not getting anything from you. And what I'm finding out, at least on Patreon, is that people really are along for the experience. So when I'm working on a page, before the page is ready, I'll put up my pencils, not the entire page, but just some figures here, some drawings there. and I'll show them sketches from a page that's coming up. They appreciate that a lot. They like trying to guess what's going to happen next. They like seeing the different ways that these characters go through development. They're there for the progress. They're there for the experience. And if you're holding everything back and then dropping a 40-page package on them, that there's something to be said for that. I get it, especially if it's something that you want them all to read and really get immersed in. But you're giving up that daily and weekly experience of traveling this journey with you.
Right, right. Well, I think that answers Ryan's question pretty well. And so I'm going to jump us in, Bradley, to our next patreon.com/comiclab question. This comes in from Mike Sherry. And Mike writes in to Brad, and I don't know why I just said to Brad. Mike writes in to Brad, hey, Brad, to hell with Dave. No, Mike writes in and says, I've been reading the book Peak by Anders Ericsson, which describes the use of deliberate practice to gain expertise in a skill. Deliberate practice is the idea that you should practice regularly with a specific goal in mind, push yourself slightly out of your comfort zone, and use objective measures to evaluate your performance. It's fairly straightforward in things like basketball and chess. Did you win the game? Or a orchestral performance? Did you play all the notes? I'm returning to comics after about 10 years off, and I'm trying to get my art and writing up to snuff. I'm in my mid-30s, and I don't have the same kind of free time I did when I was younger, so an efficient practice plan naturally has a lot of appeal. The problem with deliberative practice is that in comics, it's largely subjective. Can you think of any objective measures that I can use to evaluate my practice and progress my work forward? Brad Geiger, deliberate practice, as proposed by Anders Ericsson in the book Peak. How could that be applied to amateur, pro-am, professional cartoonists in their own practice of cartooning?
Man, oh man. I'd love to tell you that I've got some great strategies for you, but I think when we're talking about comics, we're talking about two different crafts that are used together, art and writing. And neither one of those are things that you can say, I'm going to, I don't know that anyone can give you the most efficient way to become a good writer in the least amount of time. I don't know that and the same thing for art. I don't know that there's an efficient, I get that you've got less time than you used to have. I get that. And it would be great to find some way to maximize your time. But we're talking about what is at the heart of it, a subjective pursuit. In fact, I even reject one of the examples you used. To become a good orchestral performer is much, much different and much more difficult and much more subjective than did you play all the notes? I mean, come on, I could play all the notes. I'm not ready for the Philadelphia Philharmonic. So I don't know that I can give you a good way to do this. I think instead of counting the hours or counting the minutes that you practice and then just say, okay, I did 3 panels today, I did 4 panels today, I think it's much, much more important that you concentrate on the actual things that you need to do to be a good writer. And that is stuff like you need to read a lot. You need to write a lot. You need to practice. You need to go back and look at your old stuff and evaluate it with a fresh mind. All of those things that we talk about on the show so often, I think that those are necessary things, and there's no part of art that is efficient. Am I missing something here, Dave? Am I just being a pessimist?
I want to say this is one of the advantages where having a friend on the show can course correct us from what we think we are to what may be closer to what we actually are and do in our own art making. And here's what I mean by that. I personally think that Mike's question can be tracked in a logical way by time put in and output created, right? Mm-hmm. Not the subjectiveness of, was this joke funny? Did I make people smile? Right. That's like saying, how many rainbows did that cloud create? Like, there's no way to logically work that out. But
yeah,
I think you can make a deliberative and measurable set of actions in cartooning. And Brad, as a friend, as an external looking in on your internal life, I think that you actually have far more deliberative actions and deliberative practices that you do on a daily and weekly and monthly basis than you're even remembering right now. So I'm going to go through this list, and you tell me how much of this is Brad Geiger.
Okay.
Do you have a checklist of a minimum number of Evil Links that you have to do every month?
Yes.
Do you have a checklist of the minimum number of After Darks that you have to create every month?
Yes.
Do you have a checklist of the minimum number of Comic Labs and Pro Tips you have to record with me every month?
Absolutely.
Do you have a fairly set of hours that you try to go to the studio to work?
That's true.
Do you espouse for over 20 years now that you can't get worse at something that you do every day?
it's very difficult to get worse at something you do every day. Yeah, yes, I espouse that 100%.
Do you find that even in your free time, you're a little bit reading and researching how to get better at the thing you do in your work hours?
Undoubtedly.
So what I'm getting at is you have built up practices that you don't even associate with being deliberative practices anymore. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like, you have built a system that now seems so natural to you that you don't remember that you built that system.
Right.
You know? And so that's why I'm saying, as a friend looking in on your life, if anything, Brad, you are one of the most deliberative cartoonists that I've ever met in my life. You have frickin' checklists out the yin yang. And at the end of the month, I look over all the exclusives that you've made for Patreon or this or that for Evil Link or all the stuff that you've done. And I'm like, dear God, how does he get it all done? And the answer is because you have a deliberative practice in how you create cartoons. And so while you and I can argue about whether subjectively you're getting better or worse at, that's a bad thing to say, whether you're getting better at being a cartoonist.
Yeah.
There's no argument that you and I can have a checklist of, like, how much time did Brad put into his cartooning this month? Okay, check. How much output did Brad have from his cartooning this month? Okay, check, right? And so I would argue for Mike that you can set up a schedule of deliberative number of hours that you will put into your cartooning every week and get demonstrably better over the course of a year, right? Mm-hmm. And I can say to Mike that you can make an objective checklist of deliverables that you will produce, if not for the world, for yourself, of one free sketch, one life drawing sketch, one nature sketch, one completed comic every week, whatever we want to describe as an objective finished product. Every week, every day, you will get better over the course of a year. That's what I'm getting at, Brad. You know?
Yeah. No, in that respect, yes. I guess the only part that I feel that we owe more on this question is it's one thing to say I'm going to do one comic a week, but what he's also looking for is an objective metric on whether he's getting better. How could we offer anybody who wants to do something like this, a metric? In other words, it's great. I do believe what you're saying is true. Just by doing this and being present and paying attention to what you're doing, if you keep doing it, you are going to naturally get better at it.
Yeah.
But how could we give someone objective metrics to measure that?
I'll tell you, the objective measures arise from the continued process of doing the thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I'll give as an example because I'm starting out with it. I've been doing a dribbling amount of gardening during the pandemic because I've been trying to distract myself, right?
Right.
And I'm pretty bad at it, but yeah. I'm getting better. And in doing the gardening and in getting better at it, I'm setting better objective measurements of how I'm doing. Does that make sense? Like, the process of doing is also giving me a better editorial eye about what I've been doing wrong in my gardening, how I can do it better, how I can objectively try to approach it from different angles. And so it's only in the doing that you can figure out the checklist that will make you a better cartoonist, guitarist, gardener, orchestral violinist, you know what I mean? And so you have to do it. And granted, this is partially why people pay for instruction. It's partially why people pay for art school, is because that's a cheat sheet towards someone who has already developed their editorial eye, looking at your things and going, here is what you need to do. Here are the things that I want you to do to get better, right?
Yes.
But in the process of doing it on our own, the very act of doing it gives us a better and improved editorial eye to give us an ever increasingly difficult series of steps to do to get better, right?
Yeah.
And so I know that sounds almost silly to say it out loud, but it's in doing the thing that you get better at structuring how you can get better at doing the thing.
Right. So what you're saying is put your head down, scope out time every week to do your comic, commit to it, And as you're doing it, you're going to find how you're getting better.
Right. And what Mike wants is, and I get this, he wants to say, how can I either skirt around pitfalls, or how can I efficiently do this so that, and unfortunately, part of the process, and this is true with any endeavor, mm-hmm. is that only in doing it and in discovering the pitfalls can you then learn from it and go on to structure a better system, a better way of doing it, a better set of goals, right?
Right.
And partially why we always say, you know, you have to make the mistakes is because
yes.
Some of those can't be cut. You have to do them. Even in, with a goal of efficiency in terms of, like, I want to do this in 2 years versus 10 years. I
yeah.
get that. But sometimes you have to go down a blind alley and go, oh, well, this didn't go anywhere, in order to see and learn from for the next project to do it better. Right.
Yep. Oh, and my wife said recently, she was listening to the show and we were listening about how I said I should have ended Greystone in 2 years earlier than I did. And she said, you don't understand. She says, you couldn't have, and you wouldn't have learned the lesson. You needed 4 years to learn that lesson. You would have never learned it in two. Right.
Yeah.
So whereas I could say, oh my God, that's time wasted. She could, speaking of being an objective third party, she said, you couldn't have, you needed 4 years to learn that lesson. You learned it. That's how, as somebody else might've learned it in two, somebody else might've learned it in 10.
Right.
You needed four. Four
you
is
needed
the number
four.
You needed, and that's what you needed. And she said, you can't bemoan that because you are who you are.
Right. And sometimes, I'm going to use fire as an example. A child, sometimes a human being, let's just not say a child, let's just say a human being.
Yes.
It's not enough to burn your hand once on a hot object.
Right.
Sometimes your objective brain goes, well, maybe that was a fluke. Maybe the object's not hot. I'm going to, oh God, it's hot. Ah, geez, Louise.
Still hot.
Right. And sometimes you need to keep burning your hand in order to go, God damn it, I guess it's always
yep.
hot. Right.
Yeah.
And it's like that Persian proverb, the lesson will return to you until you learn it.
Yes.
You know, you're going to keep getting the, and Brad had to keep going for 4 years on
yep.
Greystone Inn until
yep.
he learned the lessons that Greystone Inn was trying to teach him. You know, he had to struggle and fail and struggle and fail until he learned the lesson and then applied it to the next one. And so
yep.
I get and I respect and I understand why Mike is asking, how can I efficiently sidestep some of these processes and steps? Because mm-hmm. I wish I could do that now for my next steps in my career, right?
Like we
only have, you know, 75 to 90 years on this planet.
Yes.
And so you want to get as much done as you can in the limited time you have. I get that, Mike. But I think the best objective guidelines I can give to you as a friend is to say the two best objectives are time put in,
mm-hmm.
because that's an objective truth that you can check off at the end of the week. I put
yes.
in 4 hours. I put in 8 hours. I put in 10 hours, right? And then the other objective truth is output. Did you do the four things on your checklist with mm-hmm. the time that you had and
yes.
finish the things that you were going to do? Now, the subjectiveness of them, were they good? Was the line art good? Was the line quality good? Was my coloring good? Was my writing good? That's a different thing. That will come with time
mm-hmm.
and a better editorial eye. But for now, I think the objective, deliberative practice of putting in time and output as a checklist is the best I can offer you. Don't you think, Brad?
Absolutely. And as long as you mentioned your garden, Dave, were the banana trees grown from offshoots of a mature tree, or was it grown from seeds? Do you know how you can tell?
I don't know.
You can tell, says Patreon backer Mark Ashworth, you can tell from the fruit. If it doesn't have seeds, it wasn't grown from a seed. From a seed, yeah. In other words, if it was developed from an offshoot, then it won't have seeds. If it was grown from a seed, it will have seeds.
Well, that's interesting. Not that we need to go back into gardening, but when I had that, do you remember how I said obliquely, Brad, in that conversation, I said I had a fully mature banana tree, but then I also had two or three smaller ones?
Yeah.
Those smaller ones were ones that I had actually cut off as offshoots from the main one and replanted in different parts of the yard.
Ooh.
So that's interesting. Fun fact. I did not. First of all, I thank them for sending that in because I did not know that. But also, it is fun to know that there are certain plants that you can move around and replant. And banana is one of them.
Yeah.
So it was also I should have course corrected one thing. I don't know that the fruit that grew from that could correctly be described as a banana. In this sense, I know that bananas are like tomatoes or potatoes in the sense that there are 400 breeds of that kind of fruit, but we only in a commercial grocery store see like three of them, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
This was not a banana that you would normally see in a U.S. grocery store. It might be closer described as a plantain. It was banana-like.
Oh, yeah.
It was like 3-4 inches tall and stubby, which is why there was like 150 of them on that branch. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like the gigantic ones that you get from South America that are seen in a lot of grocery stores. Anyway, why did we bore people with that banana talk?
Well, I thought it was interesting. He sent it in for his $5 question this month, and I thought that was interesting enough to share. But listen, before we wrap up the show, I've got a real quick shout out to another Patreon backer, Tim, who's asking about mechanical pencils. And this is just going to take real quick. I'm going to make Tim's day. You ready for this? Okay. Tim's writing in and he goes, I've been trying out drawing in blue before inking, which, by the way, if you're just starting out or if you didn't know, the reason that a lot of people use blue pencils and then ink over it is that when they scan it in, they can make the blue drop out very easily. Mm-hmm. They don't have to erase it. That's why it's called non-photo blue. They can put it through a scanner, and they can make that blue drop right out. And this is what Tim's been doing. Here's the problem. Tim, like me, likes to use a mechanical pencil to draw. And he's really missing his mechanical pencil. And he says, what do I got to do? I like drawing in blue. I like not having to erase when I scan. But geez, I miss my mechanical pencil. Well, Tim, I'm going to make your day. They make blue mechanical pencil lead.
They sure do. Yep.
You can get them at Amazon. You can get them at Staples. You can get them at any number of places. Just throw it into your favorite online store or your favorite. Go if someday when we actually walk into stores again, walk into your office supply store. And I can confirm that they make them in 0.5 millimeters. And if you like them a little bit more chunky like I do, the 0.7 millimeter, but they do make them in blue and red, by the way, if you wanted that. But if you're looking for that non-photo blue experience with a mechanical pencil, all you got to do is buy the leads.
And non-photo blue, for those that are not familiar with it, if you're creating original art that you might want to sell, there is a type of audience that likes to see the undersketch. I tend to do original art that is just the ink itself, right? There's no pencil markings on the page itself. It's just the ink coming through a light box. Mm-hmm. But there is a unique look and style and aesthetic that is really fun when you see the non-photo blue pencil underneath the ink. And so, Tim, I wish you luck with that. It's kind of what's fun that when you first learn about non-photo blue, that there is a blue that photographs tend to miss or scanners and photocopiers tend to miss, is that it's like when you first learned about Disney's Go Away Green. Did you ever hear about that, Brad?
No.
So Disney's engineers and painters and set painters and like came up with a color of green that they call Disney's Go Away Green. And what it is when you walk around Disneyland, anything that Disney does not want to draw your eye to and in fact wants you to kind of skip over as though it doesn't exist, they paint it go away green because your mind and your eye kind of goes, la, 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 don't even see that thing, that weird power converter that's in the middle of a Disney street.
Can you tell what shade of green it is? Is it like lime green, grass green?
It's a very non-intense, almost gray green. I'm colorblind. Green red. So I'm not the best judge of go away green. But in looking at the CMYK of it, and by the way, for anyone that wants to use it in their color, it's also great in scene painting for an idea of what you'd like when you want to draw the eye to something else. You can use versions of go away greens and grays to draw your eye to the other thing and away from that other object. Right?
Yeah. But I'm looking at it right now, and you're right. It's like a muted green, like a little bit of gray and a little bit of green combined there.
Yeah, and Disney came up with it in the 60s, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And now it's fairly famous in terms of landscape design for helping to hide stuff that you don't want to see. It's really useful for trying to describe or trying to create an experience in an environment when there has to be a light pole or a fence or a box that has to be there, but you don't want people to notice it. So you paint it go away green, and it's kind of fun. And
that's I just had a realization. I know where I've seen that green before. My wife just bought me an entire outfit that's got that exact color.
It's weird when she got you that sunscreen that like goes on in go away green.
And she said, put it on head to toe.
Yeah. She said, your skin is so delicate, my lovely Brad. I want you all in go away green. And then served you those papers. That was also interesting.
Those are the worst tasting papers I ever had. But then that means that you've been listening to Comic Lab, the show about making comics and making a living from comics.
Your hosts have been, and I hate to see him go away, my friend Brad Geiger, the editor of webcomics.com and the creator of Evil Inc. at evil-comic.com.
And the man that my wife sent the Get Your Heine Over Here Purple.
What? That was such a long walk for that joke.
I had no idea where that was coming from. And my friend, the good, the delightful Dave Kellett, co-director of Stripped and cartoonist of Sheldon at SheldonComics.com and Drive at DriveComic.com.
For the briefest of moments there, you sound like you got hit by a steel pipe fitting because you're like, and my friend, the delightful, the good, the merry Dave Kellett. The French.
No.
Anyway, the Comic Lab theme song is used with permission from Andy Creighton at theworldrecord.net. And this episode was edited by Matt Woodard of Woodsong Productions over at www.woodsong.media. And of course, our sponsors for this week, the good folks at Wacom over at wacom.com.
If you love Comic Lab, you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, and you may hear your review featured on a future episode.
And speaking of those kind words, I wanted to interject by saying there are literally thousands of you listening to Comic Lab right now, but there are only 213, Brad, reviews on Apple Podcasts. So for those of you that can't support the show, can't jump in on Patreon, this is a no-cost, milliseconds-long way for you to help Brad and myself. It only takes a second to go add a review over at Apple Podcasts. I hope you do. Give us a 5-star review, a few kind words. Gosh, it will help the show find new folks and get out into the wider world. And we thank you in advance for your help with that. And on that note, I'm going to say Comic Lab is made possible by your support at patreon.com/comiclab. So we'll go ahead and say that twice. patreon.com/comiclab. Okay, wait a minute. What the heck does shrift even mean? How can you give someone short shrift? Let's not look it up. Let's just try to figure this out. What does shrift mean?
Oh, shrift sounds to me like a measurement of wheat. I've got 50 shrifts of wheat right over here. Don't give me 49. I'm not going to get short shrifted again.
I'm seeing someone with a chin beard named Ebenezer. He's like, I've got 7 bushels. You shan't shrift me. No. Wait, was that the wrong accent for what I was trying to describe?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I've never heard it. For Amish, you got to go a little bit German.
Now, you grew up in Michigan. Can you do Amish?
Oh, no. No, I can't. My mom, I was living in Ohio and I lived there for about 4 or 5 years. And I was always trying to get my parents, who don't like traveling very much, I wanted them to come to visit me. And I said to my mom, you can bring grandma. My grandmother on my mom's side. I said, you can bring grandma down here. We can take her out and go see the Amish farms. And my mom just paused and she says, oh, Brad, your grandmother hates the Amish.
It's so random.
And there was never an explanation. There was never anything. It was just your grandmother. Like there was a longstanding feud between her and the Amish, and we were not going to get invested in that.
Oh my God. You mentioned this to me once before, and I'm still confounded by it because it's so like, oh, Brad, your grandmother hates ham sandwiches. It's like, what happened? Wait, I want some backstory on that.
You do not put a ham sandwich in front of that woman.
That's you know a ham sandwich killed her uncle. You know, like what did the Amish do? How did that go south?
I have no idea. I think she's just, I remember grandma and she was just.
Did she have a buggy run over her foot at one point? Like what?
They drove her buggy. She just, at some point, she really loved buttons and she didn't understand why anybody could not.
wait a minute, is that an Amishism? You can't use buttons?
Is it either you can't use buttons or you have to use buttons? I thought it was that they couldn't use buttons.
Like,
they
like
can't
the
use
idea
any
that,
kind of fasteners.
Right, there's a certain level of technology, I get it, that they're like, no, that's not well. I love the idea that if you brought Velcro onto an Amish community, they'd be like, the work of the devil!
Get thee behind me!
Get behind me, Satan! And you're like, but look at my kid's shoes come on and off so easy.
My zips.
My zips.
You remember zips?